I can't remember when I first heard the name Clotilda. I'm fairly certain it was on a one-off episode about the finding of the wreck, an episode of a history podcast I could name now if my life depended on it. Perhaps it was part of an unearthed episode for Stuff You Missed in History, which I've long loved. If you're like me, and likely you are if you listen to this podcast, then you devour and you devour when you find a podcast you like, hosts you like, shows you like, and episodes are often wonderful, but they sort of bleed together after a while. I'm a runner, and when the pandemic began in early 2020, I channeled a lot of my anger and fear, of course, that we all had, but I channeled it into these long, long runs, 10 miles at a time, and not every time, sometimes. And I'd consume podcasts frantically while I ran, hungry to feel connected to people, to places, to spots that I couldn't travel to anymore, not then. And so that's how the story of Clotilda first whispered in my ears. A ship, a slave ship, which sailed in March of 1860, half a century after the slave trade was officially abolished in the United States. But the system of slavery was such a part of the fabric of this country, crucial stitches in a metaphorical garment of American capitalism. The very buttons on the coat is a better analogy for many owners. And yes, let it never be forgotten in a single second of this conversation that I am speaking of ownership of human bodies, the internal repopulation of slaves. So for these owners, the internal repopulation of slaves sufficed. But for some, it was a stifling proposition, and they went to great lengths to continue the network of trading underground and importing slaves in the water, and often underwater is where people ended up. The Clotilda carried 110 men, women, and children from a shore in Africa to the Mobile River in Alabama. Its journey was the product of a bet between two Mobile men, one with dollar signs in his eyes and the other mostly with generalized spite in his. A bet, a handshake. Upon arrival, the men burned the ship to hide the proof, the evidence, allowing the slaves just seconds and moments to leap from it and hide in the swampy marshland, the brackish water swarming with bugs and disease. And so there, the Clotilda sank. On April 13th, 2018, an Alabama reporter named Ben Raines pulled a piece of it up into the light of day for the first time in 160 years. He was just miles from where many descendants of the Clotilda survivors still live, in a place called Africatown that is such an important American place and American story that your breath will get caught in your chest, I promise you, if you've never heard anything of it before today. 20,000 ships, at best estimate, sailed in service of this global slave trade, and only 13 have ever been found. Clotilda is one of them. And though it lays in the mud and the brack, perhaps never to rise up into the sun again, its legacy is certainly absolutely unsinkable. I'm LA Beatles, and this is Unsinkable, the Clotilda. Hi guys, it's nice to be back. This is the first regular episode that I've recorded in almost a month. I've been traveling, been on a little bit of hiatus, been doing some research, and it feels nice to be back in front of the microphone. I apologize if my voice sounds a little bit gravelly in this episode. We are in full-on pollen assault mode here in Texas. My allergies are just absolutely out of control, so I apologize. The first thing I want to do before I get into the episode is I want to extend a massive thank you to each one of my new Patreon members. I am overwhelmed with gratitude for your support. this podcast is 100% independent. It is a one-woman show, and your support on Patreon quite literally helps to keep the podcast going, to cover the costs that I have. And, you know, I'm hoping in the future, as travel opens up and as the podcast continues to grow, the numbers continue to grow, I'm hoping that eventually some travel-related episodes will come into play. Would love to even think about doing a live show or an event at some point. So your support of the pod is such a big deal. So I would like to thank, and there's a lot of you because I haven't been on regular episodes the past month to do the shout outs. And so I apologize for the delay. I would like to thank Alexia. I would like to thank Matt Allen. I would like to thank Bryn. I would like to thank Aaron Herm, Gina Oppenheim, Wendy Lloyd, and Amanda Hahn. You guys are the best. All right. I did just want to mention really quickly before I jump into the story of the Clotilda that I want to extend a little bit of a heads up. Warning seems like too strong of a word, but if you are someone who maybe has children that listen in the background as you play these episodes, this one may be one to think about not doing that. There are some pretty brutal descriptions of the slave trade and the historical realities of slavery that I speak about in this episode. Brutal, important, and necessary to speak of, but perhaps triggering for you or people that listen with you. So just something to keep in mind. There's not a lot of it, and I don't go into intense detail, but it is something that obviously is addressed in this episode. So on January 2nd, 1893, social reformer Frederick Douglass, who had been born into slavery in 1818, gave a speech dedicating the Haitian Pavilion at the Chicago World's Fair, also known as the Columbian Exposition. He stood there and he lauded the legacy of the slave uprisings in Haiti, part of a successful revolution almost 100 years prior at this point, and turned on its head what white Americans thought about Haiti as a place, Douglass did. Literally, he did this at the International Expo named For Columbus. He urged people to conceptualize one of the places Columbus supposedly, quote unquote, discovered. Upturning narratives is not a 21st century thing. Douglass was already doing this. The journey to that moment is American history, but also global history. The Clotilda is in that middle, but I turn to context and then we'll zoom in after. The Columbian Exposition was to represent every notion of American exceptionalism, growth, modernity, its place in an increasingly accessible and economically and culturally linked world. But just over 100 years prior, on the eve of the American Revolution, African-American slavery was legal and relatively unquestioned in almost every corner of what we think of as the New World. The slave trade was, for four centuries, beginning in the 1400s with Iberian plantation agriculture in the Atlantic Sugar Islands off the African coast, an integral part of European expansion, of the settlement of the Americas, and the growth of every nook and every cranny of the United States as it rose colony by colony, then state by state. So often, slavery in America is presented as a Southern problem, a Southern institution, a sidebar in early America. It is no sidebar. It is American history. It is early American history as well. And it would be impossible for me to cover the entire history of either the American slave experience or the global slave trade. Doorstops of books have been written on each. And I don't say that in a derogatory tone. They're amazing books, but they have to be doorstops by their very nature of what they cover. As well as the abolition movement in the United States, that's another thing I just don't have time to cover. There is so much wonderful literature, which has a much more complex and longer history than most people ever realize. I will recommend some books throughout this episode, but also on the show notes, and I will link those. But I just wanted to say what I can do here in this episode is offer some basic context at the beginning, and then as we go, I will continue to. I talk a lot on this podcast about busting open myths, and I don't think I'll ever do an episode where it's more important or applicable or crucial to do just that. There are 17,000 to-do items in terms of performing surgery on the history of slavery. A few myths that must be kept in mind. First, as I mentioned a moment ago, the enslavement of Africans was not confined to the American South, but occurred all over the world, from Britain to Brazil. Secondly, and perhaps most importantly, it was not some accident. It was not some unfortunate, fated, haphazard thing that you see it written as a lot. And I think that was a narrative for so long that, to be frank, let a lot of people off the hook, you know, if it was painted as something that was sort of haphazard. But it was scientific. It was planned. It was often industrial. Plantations in the American South, for example, they were factories, essentially. They were brutal machines with black labor at their center, enslaved black labor. It was not an archaic system. It was not some backward, temporary system run by fools. It was a purposeful system run by professionals and those who fancied themselves elite businessmen. It's also really unsettling as a historian and just as a person and a reader, because even now in 2022, histories of early America seem to just jut the issue of slavery off to the side and only address it when it's convenient. I don't really like to chalk names and specific books on this podcast. I don't ever want to drag anybody, but I'm going to change it up, but I am going to mention one here because it was a little disturbing for me. I think the perfect example of what I'm talking about here is a new book by Nathaniel Philbrick called Travels with George, in which I wanted so badly to love it. And in it, he sort of traverses the same routes that George Washington took as he assumed the presidency and went to kind of meet and greet people all over the country at the time after the revolution. And I love a travel memoir, and I obviously love any history book from any era of American history. If it's on the new shelf at the bookstore, it gets me excited. And let me say, Philbrick is pedigreed and he's published and he's quite successful at what I talk about all the time, which is writing accessible and popular history that is also meticulously researched. But in this book, he lauds Washington's diplomatic and political skills, talks about him at times being shy or humble, while offering that his role as a slave owner should be considered kind of something off to the side, and mostly as a product of his time and environment. I didn't think we were still using that argument. And once I got to the story of, this is real, George Washington maniacally hunting down a woman, an enslaved woman that ran away from his household because she was not happy. And he maniacally sought her out for years and years and years out of spite. Once I read that, and once I just thought about him, Washington, and this book as a whole, I felt bile in my mouth and I physically couldn't continue. We can't make that argument anymore. It can't be, slavery can't be something to the side anymore in a separate chapter. It just can't. Slavery and the African slave trade is in every breath of the global tale of the growth of capitalism. The Atlantic slave system built and foreshadowed a modern economy, international investment of capital in far-off lands. Low labor costs, or slave labor, to produce goods for a mass market. Sound familiar? Over the 400 years of the Atlantic slave trade, from the late 15th century to the late 19th, 12.4 million souls were loaded onto ships, what historian Marcus Rediker has aptly called mobile prisons, and taken around the world, carried through the Middle Passage across the Atlantic. Along the way, Roughly 2 million of them died, and most of the ones who survived were thrown into the violence of the plantation system. And it's at the very core of every notion we have about revolution. I mean, talk about myth-making. We think about revolution and we think about the French Revolution, or we think of the American Revolution. Revolution is such a white concept in many of our minds, and I obviously can only speak to being educated here in the United States, but in the U.S., it's often confined to our thoughts about New Englanders in the 18th century. But for starters, is it not more revolutionary that the Union in the Civil War, as historian David Brian Davis has pointed out so astutely, is it not more revolutionary that the Union actually confiscated without compensation during the Civil War, at the time, a legally accepted form of property, human bodies, worth an estimated $3.5 billion in 1860, a sum now adjusted that would be perhaps closer to $100 billion. Frederick Douglass spoke in 1893 about the Sons of Haiti. And if you listen to my Joseph LaRoche episode, or if you know anything about the Haitian Revolution, then you know there is perhaps no revolution more important in terms of inspiring acts against slavery and in favor of liberty and humanity. And I encourage you to broaden your definition of revolution and of liberty to complicate it, because this is a lot, obviously, but in terms of Washington, in terms of America's first politicians, in terms of America's identity as a place built on equality and a quest for independence, is it not the most vomit-inducing truth, then, to realize that a place so wrapped up in the concept of liberty was the place that so many were stripped of theirs? There was nothing inevitable about slavery. Processes don't have a life of their own. They don't just happen. Politicians in early America chose to maintain the legality of slavery. Abolitionists were already invoking all of this irony about liberty in a slave society. The ideas were already there. The activism was already there. Black protest within the system was already there. As early as 1765, for example, slaves in Charleston watched whites parade around calling for liberty, and soon they began parading too, for their own freedom. There's an alternative universe where slavery was abolished in the 18th century, or maybe even before then. As humans, we tend to have a very scary capacity to accept inconsistencies when it benefits our pocketbooks. And just to be clear, yes, I am being overtly political, and yes, I'm asking you to reevaluate your relationship to the men we call founding fathers here in America. It's also too much to go into an episode like this, but the history of slave revolts is not confined to Haiti, but is a crucial component of the history of Black resistance and action. And I'll touch on that in the Clotilda story here shortly. Also, we think of ancient slavery in societies like Neo-Babylonia or pre-European contact eras like those of the Aboriginal tribes in Brazil as very separate experiences. We tend to think of ancient slavery and then quote-unquote modern slavery, neither of which are phrases that should have ever existed. But the through line is actually disturbingly straight. We read about the brutal ritual sacrifice and slaughter in ancient slave customs, but I mean, really, how removed is that from mobs that lynched slaves and then former slaves and then slave descendants in America well into the 20th century? Those were events in which Southern white spectators into the 20th century, you guys, literally collected souvenirs from lynchings, ears, bones, teeth. I want to preface the rest of what I'm about to present by saying that perhaps the most persistent and disturbing mythology of them all is the romanticized view of the antebellum South and American slavery. The Lost Cause mythology, which is what we call it, that turned the Civil War in the American mind into, as Davis, the historian I mentioned earlier, so astutely pointed out, a military Super Bowl between blue and gray. And the Lost Cause established a tradition of denial and veiled but accepted racism that tried its hardest to wipe out the narrative of courage an action of Black Americans. But it didn't, and it won't ever succeed. And the descendants of Clotilda's survivors in Africatown, Alabama, are one of the most moving examples of that. By 1860, when the Clotilda sailed, to be a proponent of slavery in the Deep South was to be entrenched in the concept. In 1850, the Fugitive Slave Law, part of the Compromise of 1850, and that was what admitted California to the Union as a free state, and it was heavily debated, the question of new states coming into the Union and whether they would be free or slave states. Basically, if you don't know, the Fugitive Slave Law, when it was passed, it basically meant that if your slave escaped and escaped to the North, the Southerner could go in or send someone in to snatch them, hunt them down, follow them, chase them, get them back so they could be re-enslaved. And that felt and was, I mean, in so many ways, everything about that is a violation of human liberty, but that really hardened this line between North and South. Pro-slavery theorists worked to convince businessmen, particularly newcomers to the South, of their belief system. So if you still supported slavery in the 1850s, you had made a very, very, very conscious decision to do so because abolitionists were very active at this point and times were beginning to change, particularly in the North. Finally, people's minds were beginning to change. We talked a little bit about this in the book club episode with Gareth Russell in terms of the Titanic passenger Isidore Strauss, because his family is an excellent example of this. They were newcomers to the South, and they were not necessarily proponents of slavery when they moved to the South, and were in many ways very hesitant about what it represented, because they themselves were Jewish and had dealt with a lot of prejudice. And they were actively convinced by people in the community to consider slavery. And of course, that doesn't take the agency, and Gareth and I talk about this in the episode, doesn't take the agency away from the Strauss family. They still chose to enslave people. And that's a very active choice. And I don't want to use any passive voice, but I just want to say that that's an example that we have documented. Gareth has an amazing job about writing about the Strausses in The Ship of Dreams. So if you still haven't read his book, please do. But that really ties in very well to what I'm talking about here. And there also is another Titanic connection here. So Archibald Gracie, his family was also involved in kind of this process of coming down to the South in the mid-19th century to, you know, be a part of industry to make money. And Archibald Gracie, the Titanic survivor, his father actually lived in Mobile, which we're about to talk a lot about at the time, and was, from what I read, involved in the cotton industry and the brokerage situation there in some way. I don't know a lot of details about that yet. I haven't read extensively about the Gracies in Mobile, but just keep in mind throughout this episode that there they are at the same time, from what I can tell, the Gracies in Mobile, at the same time that we're talking about all of this. So it's all connected. And I found, and I've got a few more later on, I found that it was never hard as I wrote this episode to circle back to not only the concept of unsinkable and cultural history, but also Titanic. It seems to always be there in some theme or even sometimes in specific detail. So a man named Timothy Mayer was a key cog in the slavery system in Mobile, Alabama. A steamboat captain who also owned land, he wielded great community power in 1859. The country creeped towards war, but on the Mobile River were the sights and sounds of success for someone like Mayer, who owned a fleet of steamboats. On the night in 1859 that we need to specifically discuss, he was dining with passengers on board the Roger B. Taney, the latest of his ships, a sidewheeler, which meant that it had a paddle wheel on each side and not just one huge one at the stern. And this made it more graceful on Alabama's rough waters. And just so you know, and so there's no denying where Mayer stood in terms of slavery and the race question, the Taney, and Taney is T-A-N-E-Y, oh, and I should mention Mayer, sounds like it should be spelled M-A-Y-O-R or E-R. Get it right in your head now. It is M-E-A-R. H-E-R, but pronounced mayor. But the Taney, the ship, was literally named after the U.S. Supreme Court justice who had written the majority opinion in the Dred Scott decision in 1857, just a couple of years prior, which denied citizenship to Black people, all Black people, whether free or enslaved. So Timothy Mayer very much had a message to send when he named his ship this. Mayer and his brothers owned together dozens of slaves purchased at the slave markets in Mobile. Now, we all have a vision of a slave market as an outdoor spectacle and large, I think. I think when we see it represented in history textbooks, at least in the United States, and growing up, I remember this, we learn about it as a spectacle, and we learn about the obviously the horror of that. And that did happen on a large, large scale in places like Charleston and Mobile, and was horrific. But it's also important to keep in mind that as slavery became so entrenched over time, it also happened sort of behind closed doors in smaller situations as well. And I want to credit a listener, actually, a listener named Alec, who came to one of, he's a Patreon supporter, came to one of the Zoom meetups this past weekend. And we had a fantastic conversation about precisely this, because he works at a place where he is researching some of these questions and knows a lot about the slave trade. And he made an excellent point that I'd never thought of, which is by this time in the South, these men who trafficked in human bodies and, say, in Mobile, the cotton industry and brokerage, all these businessmen, they wanted to be considered elite. And when they went to church on Sunday, they wanted someone to look at them and call them a businessman or a broker. They were so aware of what they were doing and selling human bodies. And by this point, a lot of it happened behind closed doors of an office. Two people, three people sold. And they sort of formalized it, quieted it a bit, made it more presentable, which is horrific to think about as well. But they called themselves brokers. So by changing the language there, by purposely picking a name to be called that sort of hides what you're actually doing, you're making such an active choice there. And I think that's crucial to remember moving forward in this conversation. And thank you, Alec, for helping me kind of, you know, pull through that thread in my own brain and work on some of this writing and research. That really helped me. Timothy Mayer didn't just offer pleasure cruises down the Mobile River. His fortune was made by shipping cotton from the area's plantations to Mobile's cotton wharves, where the bales flung then all over the world. And the cotton was cheaper coming out of the South because, you guessed it, slave labor meant there were no labor costs once you purchased the slaves, picked for, quote, free by Black slaves who were expected to literally break their bodies to do so. This economy in places like Mobile flourished. There is, I would Google some images of what these cotton ports in the South looked like, but you've got steamboats running, you've got huge chutes that are built where cotton is falling down these chutes onto these steamboats, and you have slaves that are not only picking, being forced to pick, you know, crops like cotton, but then they're also working in the port on these ships or doing the incredibly hard labor of, you know, taking logs and feeding steamships. Timothy Mayer notoriously used logs and not coal. So anyway, and we'll talk about all of that a little bit more later with a specific slave that we'll speak of. But I just, you know, I can't do justice in the audio format on what a port town like Mobile would have looked like in this sort of heyday, which is a terrible word to use, but I couldn't think of a better one, of this cotton boom, of the Southern industrial boom. The Mayer wealth was a behemoth. And this is jumping ahead a bit, but it's common in Southern port cities and really all over the South, from what I've read in my studies at least, for these Southern plantation families to have generated and then continue to multiply generational wealth even after the Civil War, which you'd think wouldn't be the case. But that's too much to delve into here. Ben Raines, whose book I'm using as one of my main guideposts on this episode, it's called The Last Slave Ship. It's about his discovery of the Clotilda, has pointed out that until a very recent apparent spat within the Mayer family, and perhaps that spat was about issues surrounding the Clotilda, Timothy's great-grandsons were still considered Mobile's largest and richest landowners. But back to that night in 1859. On a run from Mobile to Montgomery, it's late, the whiskey is warm and burning throats, and a man on board the Taney suggests that slavery is on its way out. Slaves would become too expensive, this man says. The global slave trade had been outlawed by an act signed by slave-owning President Thomas Jefferson in 1807. I mean, I said this stuff gets complex, right? There's no clear lines. So slaves, he said, you know, obviously couldn't be imported anymore. But that doesn't mean people weren't still doing it illegally in the early 19th century. And historians argue that it would be nearly impossible to know how many illegal slave ships made their way into U.S. territory in these years after 1807. This man on board the Taney, this man sort of teasing Timothy Mayer about the eventual downfall of slavery, also mentioned how hard it would be to pull off something like this, this illegal transfer, given government patrol boats off the slave coast of Africa. Mayer, chest puffed, heard nothing but a challenge in every word from this man, whose identity I think is lost to history, and over a handshake, the lore states, all of the lore surrounding Clotilda, he vowed to import a cargo within the next 2 years, Timothy Mayer did, and that no one would be hanged for it. And this is a crucial comment because, technically speaking, the punishment for illegally importing slaves was the death penalty. But was Mayer really risking his life? Historians would argue most likely not. Another illegal slave ship had been caught recently, and its captain was thrown into jail on adjacent, random, mild charges, but never put to death. It's possible, according to one source, that 85 ships were illegally outfitted for slave trading in 1859 in New York alone. It was happening. It was just clandestine now. And with a network of pro-slavery helpmates situated across a national network, then it was possible to get away with it, 100%. And to note, the $1,000 put on the line was inconsequential to Mayer. This was a paltry sum, at least for Mayer's side of the question. I don't know about the other guy. But it wasn't about money. It was about outwitting the federal government and about importing humans. And in that sense, it might have been partly about money, because not money from the bet, but rather the going market rate for slaves, which is terrifying and disgusting to even talk about this. But a male between the ages of 18 and 33 at the time, considered a, quote, prime slave, could be sold at auction for about the equivalent of $50,000. Mayer had moved to Mobile in 1835 from Maine, where his dad had been a stonemason, and they had had a lot less money. His dad was an Irish immigrant, and this was a common story for young men to start fresh, so to speak, in the South. This was the same story of Titanic victim Isidore Strauss's father, like I mentioned, and Mayer and his brother started as deckhands on the steamboats. He had large mutton chops. He was 23, with a wide nose, chin-length hair brushed to the side. There's a picture of him in Ben Raines' book. And I mean, not surprisingly, Timothy Mayer is a little scary looking. If you've never Googled what a steamboat looks like, also please do that at this point. I forget that a lot of people don't have images of them in their mind, because I grew up being bombarded by images of steamboats. I grew up in a town called Shreveport in Louisiana, and the founding myth of now as a historian, I've never gone back. I hardly ever go back there. I've never gone back and researched this founding myth, but the founding myth of the whole city is that this man named Captain Henry Miller Shreve, like, triumphantly drove these logs down the river. But there were always murals of steamboats all over walls at the school and at municipal buildings and things like that. And so in Louisiana, just grew up with this imagery of the steamboat. And, you know, a lot of people romanticize the steamboat. You can still take romantic steamboat cruises in Louisiana or up and down the Mississippi River. You know, to me, that's problematic. There's obviously a beauty in the architecture of ships. And I think a lot of people who want to do things like that are appreciating that part of it, that part of the history, the architecture. But man, it really seems like, you know, the way that steamboats are depicted as a nostalgia kind of culture icon. And the way that companies, you know, the ones running a cruise or, you know, a lot of historic sites and things like that, just, I mean, sort of gloss over what they were often used for in the South, as we'll learn a lot about in this tale of the Clotilda. So it's a little disturbing. That's kind of an aside, but just thought I would mention it. Mobile was a frenetic port, third only to New Orleans and Charleston, really, in its total, you know, exports, imports. In the early 19th century, a third of its population had been born somewhere else. It was somewhere you moved to. Cotton warehouses stood squat out in the open along the water, a constant reminder of what made the system turn over and over in a place like this, what the money really was and where it came from. It was cotton. And if you made new money in Mobile, you could spend it there too by buying luxury goods coming off all the ships. Fabrics, clothing, jewels, exotic foods, and you could show it off too, as a cadre of wealthy Mobile cotton families made a society and what a lot of people probably would call the riche nouveau. The men and women on board the Taney in 1859, they are in some ways not unlike the men and women who boarded in second and first class on Titanic in 1912. Networking, displaying wealth. And we can't turn from the elephant in the room in terms of Titanic either, that the massive wealth accumulated by many of Titanic's upper crust passengers was earned inside the global economy made originally possible by the slave trade and the American economic system prior to 1865. One system served the other. There was no artificial boundary that just cut off culpability in 1865 and started the world anew. That's just not how it works. And naval history is essential here, and I'm learning so much as I research episodes like this, because ding, 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 and I didn't even realize this until I sat down to write this episode, really without innovations in sailing, the global growth of capitalistic trade never would have happened. Mobile isn't Mobile in 1860 without hundreds of years of technological advancement and very purposeful economic choices. One huge engineering step that made it all possible was the caravel, which was a faster, maneuverable sailing vessel with triangular sails for sailing close to the wind. Equally as important was the adaptation of compass technology, which was Arabic in origin, as well as navigating instruments, which allowed for celestial readings and set the stage, so to speak, for plotting latitude. Though to note, between 1700 and the early 1800s, the slave ship didn't really change that much in structure. It was a prison run by a captain, typically known for his brutality and his animosity with a crew. And it was a place that contained a war within itself, as Redeker has so eloquently written. The slave ship was such a common sight until the turn of the 19th century that building of these ships was an industry within itself. In Liverpool, for example, which became, because of this, essentially the capital of the trade. The slave ship has been an ignored place in the writing of history in so many ways, but I highly recommend you check out Marcus Redeker's book. It's called The Slave Ship. But Timothy Mayer wouldn't be the one sailing a ship to pick up slave cargo, let me be clear. It was his bet, but he delegated the work. Shocking. Shocking, huh? He had a ship in mind, the Clotilda, owned by a neighbor and a man he sometimes associated with. That's vague, one can imagine. In a newspaper interview decades later, Mayer claims he paid Foster $35,000 for the Clotilda, which had been built in 1855 and was known locally for its speed. But apparently there's no formal record of this sale. The license of the ship lists Foster as owner and builder, but another man, confusingly, as captain. Ben Rains describes it really well in his book. He compares schooners like the Clotilda to 18-wheelers now. They were designed to carry commodities, rum, lumber, rice, cotton, in and out of shallow ports. The Clotilda had been to Havana with 75,000 feet of Alabama yellow pine, 62 barrels of beef tallow, and 24 casks of turpentine. On another trip, it had carried sugar, oranges, plantains, yams. Clotilda was built to be fast, with a coated copper hull that reduced drag and cut down on barnacles and algae. This was common for slave ships. It was light and quick, 86 feet, so not huge, which we'll discuss more with a shallow hold below decks, which we'll also discuss more. Foster was apparently considered quite the shipwright and came from a line of shipwrights in Nova Scotia. In 1859, he was already 40. All in all, the plan was, you know, the ship is small, it won't attract a lot of attention, and with some clever deception, the slaves could be brought over, with the authorities thinking the ship's cargo was something like bananas. What was in it for Foster, you might wonder? 10 of the captives he'd bring back, he would get, worth close to $500,000 in today's currency. But the expedition, if you want to call it that, was highly illegal, akin to piracy, and it meant sailing open water in the mid-19th century, which in itself was still very dangerous and often disease-infested business. So if he succeeded and ended up with that money actually in his pocket, it would have been close to a miracle of sorts, and he had to have known this. While American officials might be likely to look away, there were also the British squadrons to contend with in Africa. They patrolled the waters near key slave trading ports, and by 1850, they'd captured 1,600 would-be slave ships and freed 150,000 Africans who had been on their way to the U.S., to Brazil, all over the world. A slave could be bought in the slave markets of Ouidah in modern-day Benin for $34 in 1860, and then sold in Mobile for $1,500. Mayer funded the venture with money from his brothers and from friends in his network in Mobile, so people knew about this. It was a secret, but it was one shared by many. In the light of day, but unpunished, and unchallenged, because unfortunately, I mean, think about it, who would have challenged it? We have Foster's ship log as a source, which is incredible, because obviously that's a primary source. And though primary sources also must be properly contextualized, especially here, there's really nothing that can best them in terms of getting down to an experience. But the problem with Foster's log is that there seems to be two versions, one of which he added to and edited later on, decades later. That's obviously very problematic. Ben Rains and other writers tend to agree that Foster wanted to set the record straight after he realized that Mayer was getting all the credit. Just so you know, when Mayer died, his obituary legitimately lauded him as the last person to bring slaves into the United States. This was in the New York Times. He hired 9 men from out of town, Foster did, and I'm sure Mayer was part of this process as well. He calls them random scoundrels. I call them random. They were random. But Foster calls them scoundrels. That's his word. And these were just men he found hanging around the port. But this wasn't uncommon. The way that ships were staffed was sometimes really random and haphazard, because the only people oftentimes willing to take on this kind of work, you know, boarding a ship that could already be infested with disease, sailing, you know, for months at a time where you could run out of supplies, you could get sick and die and just be thrown overboard. You're heading to places all over the world with different types of disease you've never been in contact with. Mortality rates among sailors were abysmal. And oftentimes the only people willing to take on this kind of work were just people down on their luck that needed the money so badly that they had no other choice. So the crew of the Clotilda is not that different from the crew of, you know, any ship at the time in these kinds of circumstances. The less the men knew of what they were actually doing in this scenario, the better chance Foster had of pulling the whole thing off. And on March 3rd, 1860, Foster left his wife, the daughter of the boarding house owner, in the boarding house he'd been living in, and he headed to the wharf where the Clotilda was stocked with 25 casks of rice, 30 barrels of salted beef, 40 barrels of salted pork, 3 barrels of sugar, 25 barrels of flour, 4 barrels of bread, several of molasses, and water and 80 casks of rum for trading. No wonder everyone had scurvy. The huge amounts of water and meat had to be hidden, of course, so that the ship's real purpose wouldn't be discovered in port at other places along the way. Foster openly wrote about stocking up on random dry goods, too, to trade as bribes along the way. And Mayer had handed over $9,000 in gold for the purchase of 125 women, men, and children. The Clotilda, full of hidden water and meat and manned by oblivious sailors who might have been on the run from other crimes themselves, headed to the nation of Dahomey, where a king named Gezo had made international news by breaking a treaty with Britain and selling members of other tribes to slave traders. The newspaper reported on this in such a way that basically advertised to men like Mayer that they might get away with the trade. And this is just sickening within itself if you think about the role of the newspaper there. King Gezo had died by the time Foster headed to Dahomey, and ruling was his son, King Glele, who would be responsible for the brutal capture of the slaves who would board the Clotilda. I want to pause here and address an issue briefly that I am not equipped or qualified to address on a more intricate level, and that is a discussion of the history of capture of African slaves by other African tribes and the involvement of Africans in the slave trade itself. This is a very controversial topic among historians and is a very deep conversation and an important one. But as a white scholar, I don't think it's my place to have that conversation here, at least not without a Black scholar also on the podcast to discuss it. And I wish that I had that for you today, but I don't. And also, having not read extensively on this issue, it's just not my place. I do recommend I think it's a podcast, but it may also be a YouTube channel and a website, but the African History Network, and that is run and hosted by a man named Michael Imhotep. I hope I'm pronouncing his name correctly. He did an episode where he speaks about the Clotilda and its history, and he puts it in the context of the African slave trade, and he is a Black scholar. And that episode, search it on your podcast app, that episode, and I'll try to link it in the show notes, really helped me understand what this issue is and what it represents. And I highly recommend listening to that episode if you want to start with that topic and just have a starting point. And I do want to also point out that some historians have, you know, made note, and this is important, you know, in response to these cries of, oh, Africans traded their own people, which, as you can imagine, is an argument that's been used on the wrong side of history for the wrong reasons. A lot of historians have pointed out, keep in mind, firstly, that slaveholding and class warfare was decidedly more prevalent in West Africa, where the trade developed, and was not as prevalent in other places. So that's just one tiny little component of a larger scale debate and history, and it's an important one. So on a very basic level, though, for the Clotilda story, it's crucial to understand that this is exactly what went on in places like modern-day Benin, where the Clotilda was headed. And to talk about it a little in terms of Clotilda, I can do that because I've researched Clotilda so heavily. I want to use one person's story. Kudjo Lewis was born Alula Kosala in the modern Western Africa country of Benin. What is modern Benin? The second of four children, and had 12 step siblings as well. He was a member of the Yoruba people, more specifically the Isha, which was a subgroup, whose traditional home was in the Bante region of eastern Benin. Kosala was born into a happy and, you know, successful sort of what would be the equivalent of a kind of middle class in that society family, from what I read. His grandfather was an officer of the town's king. Kosala and his siblings had a happy childhood by all accounts. At 14, as was the custom, he began training as a soldier and learned how to track, hunt, camp, you know, shoot arrows, throw spears, defend the town. The town was surrounded by four walls. The teenager Kosala was also inducted into Oro, which was a secret Yoruba male society whose role it was to sort of control and police society. So it was a very male-centered society. At age 19, Kosola also fell in love with a girl in his community, and at that point was going through the initiation that enabled young men and women to get married. So it was a process within the community. In April of 1860, though, in the midst of Kosola's training, Gezo's army, now under Glele, attacked the town, killed the king and many of the people, and took the rest of the townspeople, including Kosola, prisoner. Kosola and his companions were marched to Abome, Dahomey's capital, and then on to Ouida on the coast. That is Ouidah, in case you're wanting to, you know, keep track of these names and look these things up, on the coast, where they were held for 3 weeks in a slave pen known as a barracoon, which was a prison where captives were held before being sent across the Atlantic, and they would often be held there for weeks and months at a time. Barracoon would, many years later, be the title of Zora Neale Hurston's book about the Clotilda, the work for which she spent time with an elderly Kajo in Africatown, talking, interviewing, taking photos. And we have footage and photos of Kajo because of her. And that's how we have his story. And we have tons of sources on Kajo also because of a white writer named Emma Langdon Roche, who visited Africatown in the late 19th century and recorded some of the oral histories as well. Through these interviews, we know how brutal the attack was in the kidnapping and seizing of villages. The frail, the young, the old were often just murdered straight out. Some villagers were decapitated. Their heads hung as a badge of honor by the Dahomeans as they then marched back to their capital. The descriptions are disturbing, and I do recommend you consider all this before reading Raines' book or before reading Zora Neale Hurston's Barracoon. To be very clear, I very much encourage you to do so, but just with the awareness of the brutality that is depicted. For captives, this process stripped physically, metaphorically, in every way, and shattered entire institutions of family, kinship, village, everything. A whole life, lives just completely ruined in a moment. It was to the coastal barracoon that Foster and his crew on the Clotilda arrived much wearied from the sea. The crew had found out the ship's true mission at some point along the way and threatened several times to mutiny, eventually forcing Foster into the promise of doubling their original promised wages. So just Foster paying for their silence, essentially. It took 73 days. The Clotilda arrived on May 15th and anchored a mile and a half out from the coast. But as soon as the native Dohamians spotted the ship, they sent in haste small boats of their own men out to the vessel. It would have been obvious what was expected of them and why these men were here. Foster was matched with an interpreter and brought into the first stage of this system of a sail. It was more intense than Foster expected and lasted longer than he expected. He was expected to sort of dine with the king and his men. Was a sort of wine and dine kind of situation. He was brought in a canopied hammock. So there was this sense of theater to the purchase of slaves, and the white man coming in to buy the slaves was sort of, I mean, you know, the image of him being carried in on the canopy is, or the canopied hammock is probably enough, you know, to sort of imagine what that was like. And I think Foster had more expected maybe some spectacle like that, but then for the process to be quick, the sort of, you know, maybe he expected one meal where he sort of greets the king, they make a deal, they shake hands, he leaves with the slaves. But apparently the king drug on the process and expected him to stay. Ouida was very much a modern place in the context of West Africa. It had a merchant market, restaurants, it was filled with bamboo huts and bustling temperatures in the 70s most days, great weather, papayas, coconut palms falling, you know, coconuts and papayas just falling from the sky, seemingly. This was, like I mentioned earlier, not an accidental place, but a place very purposefully planned and very actively part of a trading system built to be that way, which makes everything that much more heartbreaking. Eventually, the deal was sealed, and Foster was also asked to choose a member of the royal court as a slave as well. The king would do this as a gesture. And Foster chose a man named Gumpa, a man possibly related to the king. And Gumpa's fate was sealed, along with Kajo's, and along with the fate of 108 other men, women, and children. Yes, children, we cannot turn away from that. A lot of the books I've read and articles I've read about Clotilda. And I get it, right? It's really hard to look that in the face, but a lot of works about Clotilda tend to sort of glaze over this, but a lot of the people that headed into that ship were children, some, you know, I think 10 years old. So all of these people had been held against their will in the Barracoon and had, you know, many of them had never even seen the ocean. They'd been marched in from the interior. The slaves who would be forcibly boarded onto the Clotilda were not all from Kajo's village. They were from far-flung tribes from all over the place. They spoke different languages, but they had become connected during the wait, in some cases, in the Barracoon, and that was at least something. On a morning in late May 1860, the slaves Foster had chosen, after inspecting their bodies and teeth, and undoubtedly in other demoralizing ways, were chained and sent in boats to the Clotilda, a process Foster, of course, viewed as nerve-wracking in his fears of being discovered or of crew mutiny. But I mean, there's no sympathy to be had for him, please. We wish he'd been caught. We wish every illegal ship had been caught. Foster was right to suspect a double cross because, sure enough, during the loading, two steamers appeared on the horizon, and the crew, threatening to abandon ship or turn Foster in, stumbled in boarding the captives. 75 were already on board. 35 made it just as the Clotilda began to pull away. So 15 of the intended 125 did not make it on board. And I wish I could say this meant that they would have been saved, but sadly, what this means is that they would have either died in the water, which was very common, or just went back to the Barracoon only to be sold, you know, to the next ship. It's hard for me to process this low of a level of humanity, the handling of humans in this way. And I teared up a lot when writing this episode and researching, and I think that's a really good thing, because I think that even as a historian who has read some about all of this before, I was moved and devastated by a lot of things I came across. And I think it's really important to challenge ourselves and to force ourselves to look some of these things, you know, square in the face. And so it was a hard episode to do, harder than I expected. And I want to apologize for bringing such a sadness into the telling of the Clotilda, you know, in the telling of Clotilda to your podcast feed. But I hope you'll agree with me that it's, you know, brutal, but necessary to know all of this. So naked, exhausted, fearful, 110 people huddled inside the hollow of the Clotilda, which was not that big. And actually, in Africa Town, at one of the recent events over the last couple of years, one of the big one of the events that's happened at the community center in Africa Town is the unveiling of some very detailed models of the Clotilda that have been done. And so descendants have been able to look at these models and really visualize how tightly packed their, you know, ancestors were into the hold of this ship. And you can, I think, find pictures of this model online, and you can definitely find pictures of, you know, slave ships and their structure and how Africans were expected to fit into these tight spaces. And it's, again, heartbreaking and gut-wrenching, but if you want a visualization there, that's very easy to find online. So two of the captives died in the hold and were dumped overboard. This was very common. It was typically more than two, but it was very common that if a captive died, it was simply viewed as a, get them overboard, clear some space kind of thing. Really brutal. There was a daily water allowance of 1.5 pints, but it was treated with vinegar to keep it from developing disease. So it was really disgusting. There was exercise on deck, but that was viewed by a slave captain and his crew as not necessarily to help or benefit the slaves themselves, but more as a way of delivering the slaves still in good shape, you know, without muscles atrophied from the trip. And so it wasn't for the good of the slaves. It was for the people who would buy the slaves. So still disgusting. And they also were fed because, again, you don't want to show up with a cargo of slaves that have no energy, lost weight, or sickly. So there was exercise, there was feeding, there was water, which I think some twisted people, some people would turn into a twisted argument for better treatment of the slaves on the ship, but that's absolutely ridiculous. No, all of this was in service to the captain and to who would buy these slaves. Foster has, in this line of thinking, often been cited as a, quote, nicer captain on this slave ship. And I just call hogwash to that complete argument. Never be seduced by the notion of a nicer slaver. There are only slavers. And, I'll talk about it at the end. But there's a great new documentary that was at Sundance about the Clotilda and its descendants. It's called Descendant. It is going to be on Netflix, I believe, later this year, so very accessible. I saw it as part of Sundance, the online festival. And in it, one of the descendants of Captain Foster is on a boat with descendants of Clotilda's survivors. And he says, "I'm really glad to be with you guys. But I also want to say I have read that my ancestor was a little bit, known to be pretty nice to his slaves." And, one of the descendants, I can't remember if it was a descendant or just one of the black passengers that was on board the ship, and might have been one of the marine archaeologists, just kind of looked at the camera, looked to the side, and then said, "A slaver is a slaver." I'm paraphrasing. I haven't seen the movie in a couple of months, but it's a really moving moment. So just never fall for that line. When the ship approached Mobile, Foster took what Raines calls a purposely circuitous route, sailing past Alabama and the forts that guarded Mobile Bay. Now, due to the curvature of the earth, ships disappear below the horizon once they are about 12 miles offshore. I didn't know this. The plan that had been arranged was for Foster to sneak the Clotilda into the Mississippi Sound and hide it at a place called Point of Pines, a marshy outcrop. Okay. There's so many names. I'm not editing this out. I'm going to leave this in so you know that this is, I get tongue twisted. They were going to hide it at a place called Point of Pines, a marshy outcropping on the coast. There we go. Mayer would bring another vessel and then transfer the slaves to it. Foster would then sail the Clotilda to Mexico to have it scrubbed, change its name, acquire fake papers. It's really incredible that these men would go to these lengths to do all of this, but I suppose it's a testament to how much money was at stake and how much of a Mayer's twisted sense of Southern honor was at stake here. But Mayer had bragged about it all while Foster was gone. And by the time the Clotilda made it to Mobile, the original plans were far scarier and far riskier. And Mayer didn't even post a lookout for the ship. Again, no sympathy for Foster, but I think this scenario really illustrates what a coward and absolute freaking jerk that Mayer was. Funny how these personality traits tend to go together. I highly recommend you reference Raines' book for what happens next in intricate detail, because Raines knows these waters in Alabama so well that he beautifully describes the bad luck that ensues and the locations that the ship moves back and forth between in a horrific folly that night. They attempted to camouflage the Clotilda as a barge pulled by a ship called the Billy Jones, and to pull her upriver, directly to one of the plantations. Some of the accounts about location were purposefully confusing, then and then in the future, relayed by Mayer and by Foster years later and contradicting one another. It's apparent now that a very purposeful disinformation campaign was a huge part of thwarting the discovery of the ship. No one can say for certain, but some evidence that Raines has unearthed intimates that perhaps the Mayer family has known all along for 160 years exactly where Clotilda ended up and exactly where the brittle skeleton of her remains laying in wait. Lay waiting, because eventually that night Foster and Mayer decide in the 11th hour to burn the ship. Foster would later complain that the ship was worth way more than the slaves he received for his role in this twisted endeavor. I cry his misfortunes, not a tear. But again, here we see the level of narcissism at play in Mayer's personality that he would so cavalierly conclude that the best option that night was to obliterate his partner's property in the name of the scheme he'd initiated and now threatened to ruin. Shock his entire life. So, Mayer had an alibi that night. He had it arranged that dinner on the Roger Taney, remember his steamboat, would be delayed by this fake scenario where the cook was sick on board. And so he had his minions on that ship play up the fact that dinner was late and it couldn't start yet. And then he went and rejoined the Taney later and showed up at dinner. So basically, he just made it look like he'd been on that ship the entire night. And then he and the passengers ate a late dinner together. The slaves were transferred to the lands of a man named John Dabney, who obviously was a co-conspirator. His plantation was on a big riverbend on the Tom Bigbee. The swampland would have been, to put it mildly, completely foreign to the Africans. The captives were expected to live in the swamp for the first 11 days, watched over by an enslaved riverboat captain named James Dennison. They were likely still chained in groups of eight at this point and likely still nude. No clothing had been provided. The dangers lurking in this water included, among many others, water moccasins, alligators, biting yellow flies, swarms of mosquitoes. I grew up in Louisiana, like I mentioned, and if you grew up in the Deep South, then you know mosquitoes are beasts of creatures in the Deep South. Mayer and conspirators gathered clothes for the slaves eventually, and they watched over them, all while watching news reports that became alarmingly accurate about what they had done. People knew what happened. People knew. The Mobile Register, which 100-plus years later Ben Raines would actually write for, commented that whoever got away with this affair should congratulate themselves. What the what? Mayer was eventually arrested, but he was, and this is crucial, brought before a close friend, U.S. Circuit Court Judge William G. Jones. Southern judges had basically, on the ground, nullified the federal laws regarding the slave trade. The main argument that they used was that once the slaves had mingled among Americans, then the federal laws no longer applied because the slaves were no longer foreign imports. That argument is, I mean, at best, as weak as like tissue paper against a dam. So Jones released Mayer based on the alibi that he'd been on board the Roger Taney. Jones also likely tipped Mayer off to what was happening next, that the feds were sending a steamboat called the Eclipse to collect the captives and, take Mayer in. What happened next feels like something out of a movie and literally, quite literally, was just a plot device in a novel I read. So Mayer gets some whiskey and he sends an employee to sneak the whiskey to the crew of the Eclipse and like seduce the crew of the Eclipse with whiskey. By the time the officers of the court appeared, the crew of the Eclipse was so drunk that they could barely stand, let alone operate a ship. Mayer moved the captives at that point to another plantation, the Burns Plantation, where they finally slept under a roof for the first time in almost 2 weeks. They were herded, really and truly like livestock, which is exactly how you have to understand exactly how many people viewed them at this time. They were owned. They were barely human, maybe not human at all in people's eyes. There is a rich historiography of the connection between, you know, blackness and slavery, dehumanization and slavery. And if you're looking for a place to start, the David Brian Davis book that I mentioned a little while ago, and I will cite in my show notes, would be my suggestion. It's called Inhuman Bondage, and it covers all of this in, and it is a thick book. It's big, but it covers a basic beginning knowledge of all of these issues. The micro of what happens to the captives at this point is so representative of the macro of history of enslavement in the American South. There is a language barrier, so there is a ton of confusion in terms of what's expected of them. Women were married off to men forcefully in the sale process, and oftentimes they were married off to men who were not even from their tribes. There was a woman named, her name was Radoshi, and she eventually would be known as Sally, and she was in the Clotilda group of captives. She's actually one of the ones who is sold off to a planter in another part of Alabama, and she was at the time of sale 12 from best estimates and sold as part of a married couple with this man from a tribe that she didn't know and possibly couldn't even understand. And just to note, Sally Radoshi Smith, she's the other person that is often cited as the longest living survivor of, you know, the Clotilda, and then therefore the longest living survivor of the Atlantic slave trade. I've seen it debated whether Radoshi or Cudjo lived longer. I think the latest information is that we realize that Radoshi may have actually lived a little bit longer than Cudjo, but you'll see the two of them mentioned a lot in that context. And Cudjo, remember, is the name that Kosala that we talked about from the village in modern day Benin. He was the one whose story I told. He becomes Cudjo. And a lot of these captives end up taking on different names because their real names are difficult for Americans to pronounce and such. So Timothy Mayer himself took 32 of the slaves. His brother Burns took 20. Foster ended up taking 16. James Mayer took 8, including Cudjo. The final 34 were sold to slave dealers to cover the cost of the voyage. And that's like someone like Radoshi. So there is this really moving story of, at one point, the captives being transported and a circus rolls by, and there is an elephant, and an elephant is something that would have been really familiar to the captives coming from Africa. And so there is this one scene that's documented where they start screaming the word for elephant and the word for home. And there is this, I mean, it's gut-wrenching to think about, but for a brief moment, they have this one connection to something that looks familiar. But you have to remember, you know, 99% of everything around them and everyone around them is completely new. The trauma was unimaginable. Cudjo later told Roche, she was one of the women who visited with him later in his life, quote, "I think maybe I die in my sleep when I dream about my mama." The Mayers, the co-conspirators, they were summoned to court, but the cases were dismissed because a court officer stated, quote, "that within mentioned Negroes not found in my district," which is ridiculous because anyone who truly wanted to find them could find them as plain as day on the Mayer land, on Mayer steamboats. Timothy Mayer put the youngest men to work right away, running the hardest and most rigorous labor, loading cotton or feeding logs into the steamboats. Foster was a little harder to dismiss in terms of his case because it was obvious he'd run cargo and that his ship was also just gone. But his day in court ended up being, guess what? April 12th, 1861, the day the opening battle of something called the American Civil War happened. The thread of his case was lost in the wind, never to be picked back up again. He never even paid a fine. For the next 5 years, the remaining Clotilda survivors were enslaved in Mobile, split up between these plantations, but they worked hard to maintain their network of communication. News traveled throughout the steamboats, up and down the river. There was a lot of collective action. There is one really moving story where Timothy Mayer's wife, Mary, took apparently a liking to one of the younger African girls and wanted to train her to work inside the house. And so she had one of her already trained slaves or maids. It wasn't clear whether the person she had training this girl was white or black. Was, you know, working to train this young African girl who's having a hard time understanding language and that sort of thing. And the maid or other slave slapped the young African girl, the young Clotilda captive. And apparently all of the other African captives came, you know, at risk of being beaten or killed, came from the fields and ran to this house to stand up for their fellow African and to make it clear that they would not stand for any violence against one of their group. The day-to-day brutalities of slavery, I think, sometimes are lost in the bigger narratives, but Cudjoe, for example, was never given an indoor room at James Mayer's house. Every day of his life as a slave, he slept just underneath the house, a roof but no walls, no protection against weather. The Africans had the added trauma of being unable to easily communicate with or emotionally connect with the American-born black slaves at these plantations. Some captives married one another, like Gumpa, the member of the royal court. He married another African named Josephine, or I mean, that's the name that she picked in America, or was given to her. I shouldn't say that. A lot of these names were given. In a lot of circumstances, they did not choose their names. They were given forcefully. Another Clotilda captive married Mayer's enslaved riverboat pilot James Dennison. But in that case, there's actually evidence that it was a partnership that was forced by Burns Mayer. And that happened too. Like I mentioned earlier, marriages were forced. As the war progressed, a lot of the Africans were able to actually end up staying together at one spot near Magazine Point, on a spot near present-day Africatown. But men like Cudjoe could not escape the rough work on Mayer's boats. He would run wood up and down the banks for the boats. So again, the romanticization... I can't say that word. Is it romanticization or romanticization? I don't know. I use it a lot, so I should know. But anyway, the romantic, nostalgic nature in which we think about steamboats is actually quite sickening. In fact, here's an important point. Frederick Law Olmsted, who designed Central Park and Biltmore Forest, he was inspired to take up the abolitionist cause after he took a trip down Alabama's rivers by steamboat in 1853 and saw the conditions. Timothy Mayer, unshockingly, became a blockade runner for the Confederacy. And now remember, Gareth Russell and I actually talked a bit about this on his episode when we discussed Isidore Strauss. Isidore was, for a short time, a blockade runner as well. And if you don't know what a blockade runner is, here's the hard truth. They were ships, that's the runner part, really, the ship, meant to evade all the Union ships that were patrolling the ports. It all comes down to the movement of commodities. The Union blockade's goal was to cut off the South from the markets of the world, like Europe, which always wanted the cotton. So a runner could make a lot of money risking passage through the blockades to acquire luxuries like wine and fabric, things the South was cut off from now, and by running Confederate cotton, turpentine, resin, out to places like Cuba, where it could then go out to the broader world. Mayer was caught, though, as most runners were, in the first of the year, 1863. But just so you know, he didn't like spend the rest of his life in prison or anything. He's, you know, pops up back later in Mobile and he's fine, which is unshocking, but ugh. The final battle of the Civil War was actually fought not far from the Mayer's sawmill and the shipyard at Magazine Point, won by a troop with a large population of black soldiers. As Ben Raines so importantly points out, Blakely State Park on that location preserves a chunk of the battlefield, but until very recently, not the section where black troops defeated white troops. That chunk had been owned by the Mayer family, used for duck hunting. In 2020, it was finally added to the park. Just goes to show you how much is happening in real time in terms of reckoning. Cudjoe said the first thing the Africans did in freedom was make a drum and beat it just like they had on African soil. And there is this notorious story that Cudjoe tells where he's in the woods and he's chopping wood. The war is over and Timothy Mayer is back in Mobile and they see each other in the woods. And Cudjoe sits down next to him and asks him to send him and the captives back to Africa because they want to go home. And Timothy Mayer, and I'm paraphrasing, but Timothy Mayer says, you have a home, you have a fine home. I mean, what, the woods? and is still living at the Mayer or the James Mayer plantation? No, thank you. And so he says no. And so then Cudjoe and the rest of the African captives vow to buy land so that they can build a community. And that's exactly what they do. They work hard. They eat just meager, small amounts, save every bit of money that they possibly can. They rent rooms in a railroad section house while they organize and regroup. The men went to work, mostly still for the mayors. And this was a monopolistic kind of local wealth that dynastic families in the South had. And here I would recommend a fantastic book called Slavery by Another Name. It's written by a historian named Douglas Blackman, who I had the privilege of chatting with at a conference years ago. It's a moving look into the Reconstruction era and how for many former slaves, I think it's Reconstruction era and into actually well into the 20th century. It's been a few years since I've read it. It covers a pretty long time span, I believe. But it recounts how for many former slaves and their children and then grandchildren, the system of sharecropping in the South essentially re-enslaved them and their families as they stay indebted to plantation families. So the system remained, unfortunately, very similar. But that's not the Clotilda story, not really. This group worked for a fierce independence in buying and claiming the land for Africatown, in embracing their identities as Africans, in staying African in so many ways because their lives had been stolen and they wanted to maintain that identity. They built a government and a social structure. They had a king at one point. They built wooden houses, lumber from the Mayer's mill. They didn't have another choice, with brick chimneys. And you can see pictures of these houses. There are pictures of Cudjoe Lewis online, and he is standing in front of the house he built. We cannot end the story here and ignore what came after the Civil War. The Clotilda's descendants are the perfect way in which to understand the Reconstruction era in the South. But lest we not romanticize the North, let me be clear. American Reconstruction failed not just because the South won, you know, this ideological war by repressing slavery's legacy and its role in the war, but also because there were plenty of racist Northerners who didn't actually want former slaves and their families to ascend economically or socially. Being an abolitionist, unfortunately, didn't necessarily mean being an anti-racist or a proponent of equal rights. Though truly, life for Black Americans has always been worse in the South. We cannot run from that. And it was into the 1930s. The 19 freaking 30s. And I will say freaking because I have clicked unexplicit on my podcast. The freaking 1930s that Southern Democrats continued to block anti-lynching legislation. That is less than 100 years ago. So we have to think about Mobile in this context, Alabama in this context, Africatown in this context, this place, which I'll be bold and say that I think in many ways is a place that spoke just as Haiti spoke so long ago, a place othered because it scares so many people still to see a place collectively act against racism. It is history unfolding before our eyes, and it's not a passive thing. It's entirely an active thing, the product of everyday decisions and everyday support, both ideologically and financially and politically. And I'll talk some more about this in the book club episode coming out in, probably within the week, because in the book club episode is on Ben Rhines' book, because Ben Rhines' work stares all of these questions in the face, dead center. Africatown has been in recent decades on the cusp of just disintegrating under the weight of pollution, illness, poverty, politicking involving land ownership. The list is long. At the time that Rhines wrote his book, just, you know, over the past year or so, only 2,000 people lived in the old neighborhoods of Africatown. The Mayer family bulldozed hundreds of rental properties that they'd built originally to capitalize on the popularity of the area. And they turned once vibrant lots, which, just so you know, at one point, like in the 1950s, was the fourth largest community in the country governed by African Americans. But they turned these vibrant lots into desolate emptiness and hot concrete, a place where there had originally been movie theaters and restaurants and community centers. The Mayers have leased lands to paper mills and heavy, filthy industry, cancer-causing industry. So how far from the Civil War are we really when we have the unquestioned and unchallenged silent power of a landlord or landlords in a place using their ownership of lands on which they once owned and beat human bodies to turn a profit, right in the shadow of Africatown, where residents now have a startlingly high rate of cancer? These are tough questions. And like I said, we'll talk more about them in the book club episode, in which I'll break down Rhines' relationship with the community, how he researched the book, came across just every aspect of the story, how he's built relationship with descendants, what the goals are in Africatown for commemorating the Clotilda moving forward, how there's every reckoning but going on, but also no reckoning going on in terms of the Mayer family, which very much still in the community, and their responsibility in the entire story. But for the rest of this episode, I want to ask you to visualize the wreck of the Clotilda itself as a cultural and historical question, a place of living, breathing history and memory, just as Titanic's wreck site is, a site of suffering, death, trauma. If energy stays in a place, then how does it settle at the bottom of an ocean or a river? What do we learn from the physicality of a shipwreck? These are questions I want to answer as I continue to do side episodes on other ships, other wrecks. And for the first foray into this special episode, this special kind of episode, I don't know that I'll crack these bigger questions just yet. I'm new to it, but eventually maybe I'll circle around to an answer of why we obsess over them, even though they're being eaten up and they're stripped and they're cold underwater. Timothy Mayer proved as ugly and rotten in his behavior as ever in the last decade of the 19th century, by the way. He finally retired from the steamboat industry when he was forced, by law, to allow Black passengers to board in regular cabins and not below, like cattle. He deliberately misled reporters in his account of the Clotilda, which, to be clear, he bragged about until his death. Sources and accounts from him and others involved, from what I have read in several sources, seem to have varied wildly as to the location of the burned ship, everywhere from Mobile River to the Spanish River to various nearby bayous, which are an ecosystem all to themselves. And this worked, even though there's evidence now, through some unearthed letters, that the Mayer family knew exactly where it was from day one. Timothy's lies kept the wreck hidden for 160 years. And it may seem an easy task, right, to find a ship in rather shallow water, but look at a map of this part of Alabama and see how many stretches, how many crevices, how many bits of marshland can hide so many secrets. More than 280 wrecks have been found in the Mobile Bay area, some from as early as the 1600s. Wooden ships, as Rhines writes, were held together by nothing often but these big nails, and these ships began to leak, and they sank. Because the plans for Clotilda's design do exist, which is a miracle in terms of sources, divers over the years have been able to identify which wrecks were decidedly not Clotilda. Another Titanic connection comes into play. Clive Cussler, remember, he wrote Raise the Titanic, and you may not know this about him, but he was actually really active in searching for lost shipwrecks. And I think one of the ones he helped to find was the Confederate ship, the Hunley. And he set his sights on Clotilda in 1995. But the Alabama Historical Society said no, even though Cussler had a pretty good track record, because a man named Jack Friend, you can't make this stuff up, was also on the hunt for it. And Jack Friend had friends in high places. So this actually reminds me a little bit of the Robert Ballard, Jack Graham competition to find the Titanic wreck, because Jack Friend was also apparently a bit of an eccentric, like Jack Graham, the oil magnate who tried to find the Titanic. We'll cover his background a little more in the book club episode, but you should know that Ben Rains is a journalist. He's a writer, but he's also a documentarian who has, and just an outdoor adventurer who has traversed the Mississippi Delta and run nature tours throughout it. He is an organic part of the place he writes about. He is so worth his salt. One day in 2017, a friend of his, someone who ran a sporting goods store randomly, suggested he look for the Clotilda after the man had heard a mention of it on a local radio show. Based on his intricate knowledge of the swamp and rivers, Rains knew immediately, once he started going through the sources, that Mayer's claims about where Clotilda were false. Where Clotilda was were false. To visiting historians and journalists, none of that would have made sense, right? It was the micro of knowing the ins and outs of these bodies of water that allowed Rains to kind of crack the code. A lot of the places that Mayer mentioned wouldn't have accommodated a ship that big. Rains dug through Foster's log, and plain as day there, Foster had stated, quote, "At 12 Mile Island, I transferred my slaves." This made sense. That location was wide. It was remote. Cudjoe had told Hurston this is where it had been, but sadly, a black man wouldn't have been believed back then, plain and simple. Even more, Rains realized the Mayers owned the land around the east side of the island. They'd sunk the ship in sight of their own homes. In January of 2018, Rains went out when water levels were low in Mobile Bay and found the bones of a ship. He took aerial photos of it. A shipwright expert immediately identified it as a ship built between 1840 and 1875. Rains published an article about his own discovery, and he was hailed right away as the man who might have finally found the Clotilda. A couple of months later, a team with divers and scholars and maritime archaeologists from the Slave Wrecks Project, the Smithsonian, the National Park Service, Divers with a Purpose, which is a great organization, and an archaeological company called Search Inc. were on site to confirm the find. The leader of the team was a man named Jim Delgado, who had led one of the last expeditions to, you guessed it, Titanic. Jim let Rains down gently when they realized the ship he'd found was too big to be the Clotilda, coming in at about 150 feet. Much whiskey was drunk that night, Rains writes. He sounds like a kindred spirit. Really hope to talk to him one day. Ben Rains, if you end up listening to this episode, you know, at some point, and you want to double back and come on the podcast, please do. Be my honor. Journalistically, Rains had done nothing wrong. He'd done nothing wrong at all. I mean, just nothing. But in the court of public opinion, it was just weird that he'd announced this, you know, at least he felt it was, that he'd announced this seeming soundbite of finding this amazing historical thing and then this anti-climax after it. Rains couldn't and wouldn't let it go, and he set off to run the first full modern survey of 12 Mile Island's section of Mobile River. He brought in a crew from Southern Miss. It took them a week to assemble the data. Very quickly, the team zeroed in on a 90-foot target, and on sonar imagery, you could see a wooden deck. Rains went back out in the water with, of all people, his mechanic, a man named Joe Turner, in early April. But as soon as they looked closer at the promising spot, it became clear that the ship had an iron hull, probably from the same era as Titanic. actually. Raines pulled everything back up on his phone. As a last-ditch effort, the men went back through the data, recombed it, randomly settled on one more possibility. While they were out there, they might as well try one more. And they phoned into the lab to get them the cross-check on the GPS information. Raines jumped into the water, into cold water, and dove directly down, pulling at logs and debris, pushing inward, diving blind because the water there is mud. It's chocolate brown. And he grasped some metal under his foot. It was hammered through a thick plank of wood, a cut piece of lumber. He tugged on it, a piece about 5 feet long with rusty nails poking out, square cut nails, handmade by a blacksmith. Ben Raines then brought up the first piece of the Clotilda to see the light of day in 160 years. And not too far, in plain sight to where he pulled it up, a little cement marker in the water said, Mayor. It would take a team of archaeologists from all over the world one more calendar year to confirm it was Clotilda, but in that moment, Raines already knew. So now we have Clotilda back again, in some ways. As Raines says, physical evidence is sometimes the only way that a past cannot be ignored. And in Mobile, the Clotilda and its history can't be ignored anymore. White politicians that never mentioned it before are suddenly heralding it as a key tourist destination, talking about how, you know, it will weave into local commerce. But residents of Africatown and the descendants of the Clotilda victims from all over the country are raising concerns over who should be given the right to not only interpret the wreck in a public history sense, but also over who should potentially profit from that. It seems a dark prospect that once again, those connected to Clotilda might have power pertaining to their past snatched away. I, for one, want to do everything in my power to make sure that doesn't happen, which is why I have done this episode. The history of this ship should be incorporated into history textbooks, into classroom discussion, from the middle grade level up to the highly academic. Clotilda sunk, but its legacy is unsinkable. The spirits of those captives, the people who took from Mayer and Foster and King Glele the greatest blow a human can, the theft of their own home, their own life, their place in this world, those are ghosts we have to learn to live with because they are the American story in their whispers and in their shouts. You can follow the Clotilda Descendants Association on social media. A new Africatown Visitor Center, I believe at the time of this recording in April 2022, is under construction and in the hands of the descendants, and I cannot wait to visit. I want to mention a few, you know, sources of mine, but there are also things that you should seek out and listen to and watch. There is, like I mentioned, a new documentary called Descendant that I believe will be distributed by the Obama's production company with Netflix later this year. It will probably be in the awards conversation for next year's Oscars, which it absolutely should be. It's really, really moving, and I can't wait for you to see it. There is also a documentary on Nat Geo that is very recent, I believe, I think it was just about 2 months ago that it debuted, and that is Clotilda, Last American Slave Ship. That's on Nat Geo. I believe that might be available on Disney Plus. I think that's where I watched it. There is also a great podcast series on the podcast Family Ghosts, which is just an incredibly moving podcast that you should be aware of that addresses, it's not really about ghosts. It's more about family dynamics, family histories, lore. I've mentioned it before. It's a really hard podcast to describe, but it's very narrative, and the host has a stunning voice and a stunning, you know, capacity to describe human emotion and human scenarios. So Family Ghosts has a fantastic series on Clotilda where they send someone in to speak to a lot of these descendants that when this series of podcast episode was made, I think they probably had production going on that like 3 years ago at this point, maybe even four. A lot of this politicking around the finding of the ship was going on. And Ben Rhaines is actually mentioned because he's meeting with survivor descendants at the time. And I don't want to ruin anything because there is a story that unfolds with one of the descendants and some answers that she's trying to get. But I highly recommend, again, that's Family Ghosts. So if you search Family Ghosts, Clotilda, those episodes will come up. I believe it was four parts. So I highly recommend that. And like I said, I recommend the African History Network as a podcast. That's a wonderful, wonderful source. And Ben Rhaines' book, the ultimate source for this episode. And I really encourage you to read it heading into the book club episode that I will post within the week. I think, you know, like I always say, you could listen to it both ways, read then listen or listen then read. But I just cannot encourage you enough to purchase the book or to head to your library to see if they have it. Like I mentioned, I will also put in the show notes my sources, and those always go, when I do episodes like this, those always go on a blog entry on my website as well. And I'll also, on both show notes and the website, put a list of just sort of recommended books if you are interested in delving deeper into the history of slavery or the history of the slave trade. And I encourage you to do so. There's a very, very, very rich historiography, and, you know, prepping this episode was like heading back to grad school. And I mean that in a good way. In grad school, I was stressed out. I did something called comps at one point where you just are expected to read and take notes on, you know, something like 200 books over four different topics. And you really just become a machine. You're making tiny little note cards. You're memorizing, you know, what historian cited this historian in this new work, and what, you know, historiographical lineage does this come from? And it's, you know, I'm thankful for those skills that I acquired. I think that's a real part of who I am now. But now when I go back and I get these books, you know, something like Redeker's book or Davis's book, and I'm in the historiography and I'm in the footnotes and I'm doing this research, it's now so much more joyful to me because I'm applying it to something, this podcast, which is so accessible and is reaching so many people. And I feel like it's just creating branches on lots of different trees that we're talking about. So it's been a really great experience. I hope that you like this side series of, you know, on other ships. I will be doing this probably quarterly, so four times a year. I am very open to suggestions on ships to cover. I think I'm going to keep it to shipwrecks because I also want to be having conversations about shipwrecks as historical sites of memory and artifacts and that sort of thing, because I think that really ties into so many aspects of the Titanic conversation. But if you do have suggestions, please email me. That is unsinkablepod@gmail.com. Find me on Instagram and Twitter, unsinkablepod. The link to the Patreon page will be in the show notes. If you're interested in becoming a Patreon member, it is much appreciated. And all of the funds go right into the production of the podcast. All right. And finally, I want to end with just a fun recommendation. I think I've mentioned it before, but I want to say over some travel that I did, and also over the course of just, you know, being in research mode and having these heavier things in my brain, there is a podcast that I turn to again and again. And when I run out of the backlog of episodes, I will cry. But it is a podcast called A Funny Feeling, and it is hosted by two women named Marcy Jaro and Betsy Sodaro. They are comedians and writers, and they have guests on, and they talk about the paranormal, you know, in the context of, you know, haunted places, haunted objects, what people believe, why people believe what they do. And they also take listener stories, and they just listen to people's stories, which are often, you know, just threaded through with grief, loss of a loved one, or just weird experiences that a person has had. And they bring such a joyful combination of lightness and humor to some very therapeutic conversations about just life. And I can't tell you how much just sheer joy it's brought to me. And so that is A Funny Feeling podcast. There are like 250 episodes in the backlog. So if, like me, you latch onto it, you are going to have so much fun just chipping back and listening and binging. So thank you, Betsy and Marcy, for being people in the podcasting space that are just doing the work and making content that brings happiness and fun. And it's a really, really well done, high quality podcast. So I know that has not really anything directly to do with history, but in the podcasting world, it's something that you should know about. All right, guys, I think that's it. Thank you for listening. The growth of the podcast is incredible. And I welcome new listeners. And like I said, I'm always here for feedback. So never hesitate to email me or get in touch. All right, I will see you soon. Bye, guys.